Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for good times.
If you were stranded on a desert island, could you listen to Dionne Warwick for the rest of your life? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. For 50 years, the desert island disc question has been the premise of a British radio program. In 1979, it became a collection of essays edited by music critic Greil Marcus. Now there's a sequel to that book called Marooned, The Next Generation of Desert Island Discs. Two of the book's contributors are here to explain their picks, and we'll find out who, in the name of all things good and holy, picked Dionne Warwick. But first, we're joined in studio by Phil Freeman, who is editor of Marooned. He's also the managing editor of Global Rhythm magazine, as well as an author and freelance journalist. Phil, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So, I guess in this age of iPods and digital singles, I have to ask, is the desert island disc concept even relevant anymore?
I think it's all the more relevant because of exactly that. It forces you to make a choice and stick with it rather than to play around with your iPod, you know, endlessly.
Well, it certainly forces you to make a choice if you accept it. It's like, you know, the old Mission Impossible. Your
right.
mission,
should you choose to accept it.
I'm not sure I would have chosen to accept this particular. I think it's an impossible question to answer, but that many people did answer the question in your book. And many of the people who picked records that were released after the original book, the 1979 book edited by Greil Marcus.
I was hoping they would, because that's why my initial hiring criterion actually was no writers over 40. The only guy who basically lied to me and snuck in was Simon Reynolds. I thought he was under 40 when I contacted him, and by the time he agreed and I found out, it was too late. And so I let him stay.
What was your rationale for this blatant display of ageism?
Very simply, music has changed a lot since 1979. There was no such thing as drum and bass. Punk was in many places thought to have burned itself out. You know, critics' attention had turned away after punk reached the sticks and became hardcore. Disco was dying. There was barely hip hop. I mean, it existed, but mm-hmm. no one really was paying attention yet. And there was almost no such thing as heavy metal either. There were the pioneering bands. Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, you know,
Deep
and
Purple.
Exactly. But everyone hated them. And it had not become in any sense the commercial juggernaut that it is now, where it's really, I would say, there's a case to be made that heavy metal is the only thing keeping rock music alive at this point.
Well, now, having heard you say that, I don't think too many people will be surprised to hear what your own desert island pick for the book Marooned was, Phil.
Yes, I picked No Remorse, the Motorhead anthology from 1985. It was my introduction to Motorhead. I've been listening to them since I was 13 or 14 years old, and they're probably never going to go away from my library at this point because they keep making great records.
Phil Freeman is my guest, sitting here in his Motorhead t-shirt. Here is his desert island pick, the album called No Remorse.
I don't see green, the only
So if Phil Freeman were marooned, the premise of his the book that he's just edited, marooned on a desert island with only a single disc to listen to, his choice would be this one from Motorhead, the album called No Remorse. And Phil, how did you select the rest of the contributors? I mean, you know, the age concern aside, how did you, I mean, there's lots of great rock critics, music writers out there who are under 40. How did you pick?
A lot of them are people whose work I had read and admired. Some of them were people I... Lena Dawes, for example, who wrote about Skunk Anansie. Met her at the EMP Pop Conference in Seattle a couple of years ago. She delivered a paper on being a black female metal fan and feeling terminally out of place at shows throughout her entire high school and college career. And I said, that's a voice that deserves wider exposure. So she's hardly published anything in the States, but I said she deserves to be in this book.
Well, now, it does seem like there's a fair representation of a lot of different kinds of music, but there does seem to be a little more heavy metal than I would have expected from a completely random survey. So, you know,
well, I have...
I know you edit Global Rhythms, a world music magazine, but you're actually about to take on another job, right?
Yes, I'm about to. Next month, I'm going to be taking over as editor-in-chief of Metal Edge, America's, I believe, longest-running metal magazine.
Okay.
So,
but it sounds like maybe a little more closer to your
a little selection bias going on there. The other thing is it runs in the other direction, which is I have an almost visceral negative response to indie / alternative / college rock, whatever you want to call it. And so I really selected away from writers who I thought were going to pick, for example, what I consider the worst band in the history of music, which is Pavement.
Uh-huh.
I knew that there was no way I was going to let that happen to my book.
All right.
So.
You can send your angry cards and letters to Phil Freeman. Phil is one of our guests on Soundcheck today. Now, the book is called Marooned, The Next Generation of Desert Island Discs. Very simple premise. You have one choice, one record that you're marooned on a desert island with. Phil, one of the writers that you have mentioned, who, you know, you've read his work for a long time and been a fan, is Greg Tate.
Yes.
And Greg is joining us on the phone right now. Greg, good to have you back on Soundcheck today.
Hey, good to be there.
Greg Tate is the author of the upcoming Flyboy 2, the Greg Tate Reader, and the 100 Best Lyrics of Hip Hop. He's also a member of the band Burnt Sugar. And your pick was what?
Bitches Brew by Miles Davis.
1970 classic from Miles Davis, the album that's often seen as kind of ushering in jazz rock fusion. Why did you pick this record?
It was interesting. I actually answered for myself that question of what's your favorite record of all time that they ask in this British magazine, Mojo, and I never really thought about it, and I kind of let my subconscious answer, and it said Bitches Brew, and I said, huh, interesting, because I don't know that I would say that's my favorite Miles Davis record. But I had to actually think about why that record was so important to me. And I think it's because even though it's seen as ushering in this thing called fusion, it really walks this delicate balance between maintaining the integrity of the jazz sensibility, the jazz approach, the improvisation, the interplay, and having, you know, these funk elements in there as well. You know, it's got a kind of... a bipolar aspect to it in the sense that, you know, it's got electric and acoustic instruments, which
right.
are really kind of hard to balance out.
And,
you know what I mean?
And Davis doing this at a time when not a lot of people had practice.
No, I mean, and partly that's attributed to the, you have to attribute that to the equal brilliance of Teo Macero.
The producer,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, because Joe Zawinul, who plays on the record, says that after they finished the session, he just thought it was garbage.
Yeah.
And he talks about going to the offices of Columbia a few months later and hearing something over the intercom system and saying, wow, what's that? And the secretary tells him, well, that's you guys. And he realizes that what he played on had been transformed into this incredible masterpiece.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. Pharaoh's Dance is the name of the track from the album Bitches Brew by Miles Davis.
Thank you.
some of Miles Davis' 1970 classic album, Bitches Brew. If Greg Tate were stranded on a desert island, that's the record he would want to have with him. What about you? We'll be asking what you think in just a little while. Greg Tate's with us on the phone. We've been speaking with editor Phil Freeman, who edited the book Marooned, The Next Generation of Desert Island Discs. Greg, you are not just a music writer. You're a musician yourself, part of the band Burnt Sugar.
Sure.
Does this pick, I mean, you said it may not even be your favorite Miles Davis record. I mean, there's Kind of Blue and Birth of the Cool and all these great records out there. What does it say about, you know, you as a musician that you respond to this particular record in such a visceral
way?
Well,
I mean, I think this was the first record that I think anyone had made that said that all the worlds of music that existed at that time and that have really come to exist since can actually coexist in an improvisational context. You know, that you can have this multi-voice, multi-headed swirl of information and ideas and personalities going, and it can be completely mystical and ritual and mysterious, and at the same time just have this incredibly profound stream of consciousness, internal logic going on as well.
So when you guys in Burnt Sugar are referencing, you know, rock and jazz and funk and even Stravinsky all in the course of an evening.
And I mean, you know, there's the other aspect to it as well, of it's electronic and acoustic, but then it's also it's electronically altered in the studio as well. It's bringing in that element of manipulation to what's been laid down in a kind of documentary fashion
in the studio,
you know, on the tapes.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there's there's something about, like, that record is mixed in a way that jazz records are almost never mixed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Thinking about the kind of detailing that goes on in that particular record and the kind of ambiance that goes on as well, the atmospheres.
As you mentioned, Tio Massaro, the great producer. Phil Freeman, this is the only Miles Davis record in the batch, but you were telling me before that it almost wasn't.
Yeah. I talk about three potential choices in my introduction. One was No Remorse. One was The Minutemen's Double Nickels on the Dime, and the other was Steely Dan's Gaucho. But there was a fourth choice, which was On the Corner, which is my personal favorite Miles Davis record. The reason I wound up excluding it was because I had written my own book on Miles Electric stuff called Running the Voodoo Down, The Electric Music of Miles Davis, which came out in 2005. So I just wanted to stay away from that particular well for the next project. But
okay.
On the Corner is an unbelievably dense sort of sound world that you could lose yourself in for years.
Which I guess is part of the point. If you're on a desert island, you want something that you can sort of be listening to repeatedly and find ever new things to uncover.
Yeah.
All right, we've got
one thing is on a desert island, I mean, most of what you're going to be doing is thinking about how you're going to eat.
Yeah.
And how you're going to avoid the
Let's
elements,
not get too
you know?
Practical and realistic
oh,
here,
yeah,
Greg.
Yeah.
Ian Christie also contributed an essay to the book Marooned. He is the author of Sound of the Beast, The Complete Headbanging History of Heavy Metal, and host on Sirius Satellite Radio's Metal Channel Heart Attack. And Ian, you picked Iron Maiden's 1981 album Killers for your Desert Island disc.
And that's right.
Your essay is a kind of detailed fantasy of actually being stranded on an ice floe near Greenland or something.
Right.
That sounds disturbingly realistic, at least when the story begins. Was this in fact based on a true story?
It's true. I did have a ledge of I did have a real foundation in that I flew back from a Melvins and Napalm Death show in London about 10 years ago, and one of our engines went out, and we did do an emergency landing inside the Arctic Circle. So I started from that, and then as we were saying earlier about this being a job you're not sure you would want to write an essay about it being on a desert island picking only one record, I felt like I definitely felt shackled by that. I wanted to go through the process of elimination, but I tried to make it as fun as possible. And
so, in fact, coming back from this, Melvin's Napalm Death concert, you find yourself on an ice floe with some DJ's kit. So
right.
it's full of CDs and LPs,
and
your job is to use the ones that you don't like as dinner plates, as fish hooks, as whatever, you know, as signals.
Bait.
For air, right, whatever. Until at the end of the story, you are left with just killers. So what is it that, you know, the Smithsonian Folkways collection goes by the boards, you know?
Well, that paper, you know, is I needed it for fire. You got to stay warm up there.
I mean, all this great classic rock, classic jazz, classic pop is all being put to other uses. What is it about Iron Maiden's killers that makes it the one at the end?
I guess, you know, it going through in the essay, I had so many different points of access for killers. It is a very civilized record, just the way the music is constructed. It's orchestrated. It's orchestrated like prog rock or something. It's a terrible way to describe it, but it has harmonized guitars and then a bass that's providing counterpoint down below. You can really feel that there are five people involved in making this. It's not... with a singer-songwriter, I felt like if I had picked a record by Stephen Stills or somebody, I would be sitting on that island with Stephen Stills, and I think I would, you know, go crazy. I'd jump into the water pretty quickly. With Iron Maiden, I felt like it was really a map of how civilization works. This is a band that you know, worked its way out of the pubs of the outskirts of London until they actually reached the big time and kind of grasped the 80s. With this Killers album. After that, they inspired thousands and thousands of bands, and they're still influencing bands to this day. I mean, you can look at death metal, you can extrapolate death metal out of Iron Maiden's Killers. But at the same time, it also goes back to the earliest metal, the records that you were talking about by Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin. So everything kind of came together for Iron Maiden, but also it's a really crucial record for 80s music in general.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's hear a little bit of Twilight Zone from Iron Maiden's 1981 album, Killers. That's Ian Christie's Desert Island disc. And what album would you take to a desolate, uninhabited island? Give us a call at 212-264-7483 or leave your comment on our website, wnyc.org. 212-264-7483. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is Soundcheck. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Now it's Sea Story, the kind that involves you being shipwrecked on a desert island. What is the one album you'd want with you? Our number is 212-264-7483, or you can leave a comment on our website, wnyc.org. Phil Freeman is the editor of the book Marooned, The Next Generation of Desert Island Discs. Who chose this music by the meters, Phil?
Jeff Chang, the
hip-hop writer.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's funny because I recognize this music from about 65 hip-hop songs, but I've never actually listened to the meters as the meters. So.
All right. Well, now, we began with Dionne Warwick, and that's what friends are for. That was another surprising choice. Tell us whose choice that was.
Yes, that was chosen by John Darnielle, who's probably best known as the mind behind the group The Mountain Goats, but he's also a music journalist. He writes for Decibel, the heavy metal magazine. And
right. The funny thing here being The Mountain Goats, very acoustic, inward-looking singer-songwritery stuff, and then the guy is really into black metal and death metal, and then he picks Dionne Warwick for his Desert Island disc. So, yeah, but which one surprised you the most out of all the essays?
That was one... I would say surprised in terms of what was actually turned in. I think Scott Seward was another one who I was kind of expecting to turn in a metal piece, and he turned in Divine Styler, which is a record I haven't even thought about in over 10 years at least. So, there are a bunch. Ned Raggett's My Bloody Valentine piece is the least surprising, though. because Ned has been obsessed with My Bloody Valentine for years and years and years. So when I asked him, I said, this is what I'm going to get, and I was right.
All right. We're also speaking with two of the other contributors to the book, Marooned, Greg Tate with us on the phone, and Ian Christie also here in the studio, and a full bank of callers to get to. But Greg, Ian, why does this... I mean, you guys both chose to answer this question. What is the continuing fascination for having to narrow a world of music down to a single album? Ian, let me start with you.
Well, I think it's kind of a game. It's not really... You can't really take it literally, and I definitely wrote my essay as a writing game on top of a musical game. If a record really affects you in a deep way, then you do go to a desert island. And that's sort of, you know, in my essay, I find an escape hatch and crawl through the sand and end up falling sideways into my own 14-year-old bedroom. And I think that's pretty much where people go, especially if you sit down and think about this long enough to write an essay about a record you've been listening to for 20 years.
Yeah. Greg?
Well, I think that, Miles is such a fascinating, almost meta figure in terms of jazz anyway, but this record in particular is one that's always seemed to me to be bigger than the sum of its parts. Mm-hmm. It's like transcendent of, in a way, it's almost like a form of criticism itself. It's almost like a commentary on all the music that came before it and a lot of music that's come after it as well. So I think it just sits in this, kind of celestial place in my idea of a musical pantheon. So,
okay.
There's something about the epic, mythic quality of it that seemed to lend itself to like a literary, kind of a transliteration, as it were.
The Miles Davis album, Bitches Brew, was Greg Tate's choice. Ian Christie chose the 1981 Iron Maiden record, Killers. What would you choose? Let's start with Robert in Queens. Welcome to Soundcheck, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's such a fascinating, mind game to play. And
it's a silly game, but let's play it anyway. What would you pick?
The first record, and I said this will be the one then, is going to be The History of Melody Nelson by Serge Gainsbourg. Which is just...
Do you speak French?
No, I do not. And that's the thing that immediately struck me. It's like, I don't even speak French. But that record creates such a wonderful, glamorous, murky, funky, sexy realm. Probably because I know the song, the lyrics are vaguely about his obsession with a 14-year-old girl that Jane Birkin is kind of playing in the mix of the, would probably kind of ruin it in a way if you actually knew what he was saying.
But
the whole feel of it, it's a dream. The record is a dream from like the beginning to the end, and it's very short, but it's just like a dreamscape, and you just kind of get sucked into it and you're gone. So that would be the one I think I would choose.
I like the idea of disappearing into a record where you don't understand the language. I think from that angle, my favorite group is probably Café Tacuba, the Mexican band, whose work is unbelievable on a musical level. And I don't speak hardly any Spanish at all, so I just sort of drift away with those songs.
All right, let's take another call in New Jersey. Brian joining us on Soundcheck. Brian, what would you take to that desert island?
I'd take Pharoah Sanders, The Creator Has a Master Plan.
That's like a good 40 minutes at a clip,
yeah.
That piece. Why?
Because you can't take Station to Station, so you got to go with the Pharoah Sanders.
Why that particular piece?
Well, I think I'm an atheist, and I think that it's religious music for those of us who, maybe have a 40-minute train ride into corporate America, just want a little Pharoah Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Greg, Pharoah Sanders recorded that album a couple of years before Miles recorded your choice, Bitches Brew. It's a kind of an odd stopping off point between late Coltrane and Miles Davis in a way.
Well, I think the thing I love about the music of that post Coltrane, post Cecil Ornette period is that guys are really taking advantage of the fact that they could put 20 or 30 minutes of music on the side of one album.
Something spiritual at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was Coltrane's great gift, is actually translate his spiritual yearning into a secular language, that did all these things that blues and jazz had traditionally done, but then he completely came up with this language that was non-esoteric,
right?
That was completely just filled with his sense of the divine, and you know, there's not too many writers who can do that.
All right, let's take another comment from one of our listeners. Jeremy in Manhattan wrote to say that if he were on a desert island, he would bring Keith Jarrett's Cone Concert, solo piano improvisation that runs actually to two LPs. He says, "The beauty and genius of his improvisation never fails to disappoint me, and I am constantly hearing something new each time I put it on. While it would not necessarily keep me company, my mind would be challenged." Jarrett's Köln Concert, recorded live, obviously in Köln, Germany, back in the early 70s. Jeremy in Manhattan chose that for his Desert Island disc. And we are speaking to the editor and several of the contributors to the book Marooned, The Next Generation of Desert Island Discs, and finding out what some of our Soundcheck listeners would take to that Desert Island. And let's go up to Westchester. Graham, welcome to Soundcheck.
Yeah, thank you. A little bit off the taste of the previous callers, but I would take Beatles One, the compilation of, I think it's 27 Beatles number one hits.
Mm-hmm.
Beatles never fail to make me happy. If I'm feeling good, I feel better. If I'm feeling bad, I still feel better. And if I'm on a desert island, I'm going to need all the help I can get.
That's a good way to leave it, Graham. Thanks very much. Phil Freeman, I suspect that part of your choice of contributors was to avoid the Beatles at all costs, but you can't screen out our Soundcheck listeners, so there they are. You guys, several of you are doing a reading at Housing Works, August 22nd.
Yes, that's correct, August 22nd. Tom Brehon, Daphne Carr, Candia Crazy Horse, Rob Harvilla, and Scott Seward, and myself will all be reading from our essays and taking questions from the audience and doing whatever else Housing Works wants us to do.
All right, that's August 22nd. Meanwhile, Greg Tate has been with us, the author of the upcoming Flyboy 2, the Greg Tate Reader. Greg, great to talk to you again. Thanks for being with us.
Always, man.
And Ian Christie, author of Sound of the Beast, the complete headbanging history of heavy metal. Ian, good to have you here as well.
Thanks. Good to talk about Iron Maiden.
By surprise. So Captain Marvel zapped him right between the eyes.
Zap! All the children sing.